I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We were reading about the quest to have President Barack Obama's presidential library in certain cities. There are several cities right now. University of Hawaii would like to have his papers, Columbia University in New York, and of course, all kinds of different competitors from Chicago. Despite the mayor's plea to have a unified bid. Presidential libraries, how many are there? Who runs them? How is it decided where a presidential library should be? And what do we find within these presidential libraries? We're going to be speaking this hour of the program with the author of Windows on the White House, The Story of Presidential Libraries, Kurt Smith. Is with us. Kurt is former presidential speechwriter and senior lecturer at the University of Rochester. He wrote more speeches than anyone else, actually, for President George Herbert Walker Bush. Kurt's a radio commentator, Saturday Evening Post senior editor, TV documentarian. There are millions of people who visit the presidential libraries each year, and his book looks at Rutherford Hayes. Yesterday we learned about all of these presidents who were alive at the time of Lincoln and preceded him in the presidency. Today we'll learn about another president we should know more about, but we don't. Rutherford Hayes, he's got a center, and also the libraries of FDR, Harry S. Truman, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush. And we'll be welcoming phone calls because I'm sure that many of you have been to those libraries. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Our guest is not in the studio yet, so we're just going to have to wait until our guest arrives. But the book is really interesting because it has pictures. I had no idea what's contained in many of these presidential libraries. You know, I don't think I've been to any of them. Isn't that terrible? Certainly I've been to Springfield many times, and there is a Lincoln Library, but it's not a big public library in the museum that is there as well, but not to these other libraries. So if you have been, please call and tell us what you saw and why you went. I've talked to people who have been to many of these. I understand, even though he was considered more a great humanitarian than a great president, that the Herbert Hoover Library in Iowa is quite good. FDR, of course, the president who dominated the 20th century, his library well worth going to. Truman's library, well, they'd all be interesting to go to. So if you've been to some of them or if you have questions about them, we'd like very much to hear from you. And you may have to be our guest as well if we can't find our guest. Our number, again, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest writes in his book that preservation really was once rather hit or miss, especially in the 19th century, and he is with us right now, so we will talk about how hit or miss it was. Kurt Smith, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad we found you. I didn't want to have to talk about presidential libraries because I haven't been to any of them. I can't believe it. I love history. I love the presidency. Have I been to any of these? No. It's terrible.
Well, you're fairly well situated in Wisconsin to be near at least decent proximity of several. The Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Library in Ohio, mm-hmm. The Harry Truman Library in Missouri, the Bill Clinton in Arkansas, mm-hmm. The Dwight Eisenhower in Abilene, Kansas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not an eternity away from Wisconsin.
All right.
And it's a wonderful day trip.
I'm sure.
Way, and you certainly would be glad once you're there that you put in the return, because the return on investment is very high indeed.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. You write early in the book, Kurt, about how preservation was once a hit or miss. Were there a lot of presidents who threw away many of their important papers?
Yeah, you know, there really were, because there was no emphasis in the, certainly the late 18th century on the presidency and the papers. After all, it was a the office did not exist until really the last 20 years, if you would, the last quarter century of the 18th century. And then even in the 19th century, there was not a great emphasis on preservation. Why would there be? I mean, our emphasis was on growth. Mm-hmm. We were a booming republic, and we had going coast to coast to prove it. The intercontinental, transcontinental railroad, and the great growth of this country, brooking the frontier, and very few people would put much of an emphasis on the environment then. In fact, the term did not exist. It was known as conservation, and Theodore Roosevelt was really the first conservation president, and he took great pride in that. And ever since then, TR really has been the gold standard, I think, for presidents or anyone who would engage in the art form and the necessity, I think, called a conservation or a preservation, or the environmentalism that I call the cathedral of the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
I know that as a speechwriter for former President Bush, that's Bush 41, not 43.
Right.
I always make that distinction or ask people who introduce me to make it for me. 41 was a great admirer of TR and was one of the great environmental presidents, I think, that we have had, dating back to 1970 when President Nixon, of course, created the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and founded Earth Day. And since then, I think, by and large, we've had presidents who have been environmentally inclined. That was not true a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not hit or miss anymore. Any
yeah.
politician that wants to have a rather lengthy career, boy, that politician had better show very soon and very clear that they're committed to the environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would have thought that George Washington might have thought someday after dinner, I am the first president of this country. Maybe I ought to save some of this because maybe somebody would want to read about all of this.
Well, Washington, I think, was too busy making history to worry about preserving history. And I think this is true, really, of so many of the founding fathers. They weren't necessarily concerned about this. They were much more activist, if you were. And it really did take the great history maker and history breaker known as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because it was in the area of being a preservationist
mm-hmm.
and a conservationist that FDR eclipsed, I think, all of his contemporaries. But why should that surprise? I mean, my goodness, FDR eclipsed his contemporaries in more ways than you and I
mm-hmm.
can mention.
Yeah, he was
four terms, two more than any president
mm-hmm.
ever had or ever will serve, thanks to the 22nd Amendment. A 1-2 crisis, I think, that no president has ever had to face. First, he had to beat the Depression. Then he had to beat Adolf Hitler. Now, I have to laugh when presidents, in essence, cry, "Oh, woe is me, how tough the presidency is. Give me a break."
It was tough.
When you're talking about the Depression and you're talking about Adolf Hitler,
right.
that's a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of them would be. But when you're faced with 1-2 and with the Depression, you had very few colleagues, nations around the world that could help you with that. And in terms of getting other allies to even realize the necessity to face Nazi Germany, very few recognized early on our side of the fence at least, that Hitler was worth fighting. Only Roosevelt did.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a person of great vision. You know, my former boss, Bush 41, he invented and poo-pooed the term the vision thing, as you'll remember. Well, Roosevelt had the vision thing. Thank God he did, or we might be speaking German today.
Yeah, he was an extraordinary man. Let's talk a little bit. You mentioned Ike, and I know that that the man you worked for, President George Herbert Walker Bush, was a big fan of Ike, and that you wove some of Eisenhower's thoughts into Bush 41 speeches, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, and, you know, Bush 41 really was the last president, I think it's fair to say. He served from 1989 through 93, who we can say was a graduate, was an exemplar of what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation, mm-hmm. and that is the World War II generation. And I was born after World War II adjourned, and my dad, in fact, was born too late to serve in World War II. But, boy, you look back at that generation, and I don't see how any objective person can deny the truth of what Brokaw said. They were the greatest generation. And Ike was one of the headliners, of course, of that great generation. Most men run for president, pledge to save civilization. Ike did it the other way around. He saved civilization, and then he ran for president. And I know because we had many talks about this in the Oval Office, President Bush and his speechwriters, Bush 41. He really did feel a great affinity and affection for Eisenhower. After all, Eisenhower had been the five-star commander-in-chief of the Allied Armada in World War II, and Bush had been an authentic war hero, had been the youngest Navy fighter pilot in World War II. He had, on Pearl Harbor, which was on a Sunday, he had gone down the next day, a Monday, and had volunteered to serve in the war. And the people looked at him, and they looked at his age, and his age was 17. And they said, young man, you're right. Too young to fight. Wait until you're 18 and come back, and you can, if you're still desiring of enlisting, you can do so then. And so it was that on June 12th of 1942, Bush turned 18, and he was the very first person at the draft board that mm-hmm. morning, and he enlisted to fight. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, at the ripe age of 20, he was almost killed by the Japanese when he was on a junket, if you will, a very dangerous air mission near Chichijima in the Pacific Theater. Mm-hmm. And he was rescued by an American a submarine called the Finback. But he came as close as you can to death itself before he was rescued. Mm-hmm. So this is a man that that as a boy faced death in a way that, you know, I think of how I was, how immature I was, how easy I had it when I was 20. And he grew up in a hurry.
And, yeah, he sure did.
You know, he became a war hero, as I said, and a remarkably accomplished human being in every sense of the term. Not simply as a war hero, but as an entrepreneur going to Texas. Then he became a congressman, and then he became ambassador to the United Nations for the United States, and then he became head of the CIA here in the U.S., and he became America's ambassador to China, which was exceedingly important because China was really entering the mainstream of nations in the 1970s, and then he became vice president, and then he became president. I mean, his resume may have been the finest in modern times.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's become, in retirement, if you look at polling, he's become one of the most beloved former presidents in American history. And, of course, he's amazed the country. By every fifth year, he has jumped
out of a parachute.
Parachute,
I know.
Yeah,
amazing.
From a plane.
Yeah,
and he's
I know.
Done it because two of his crewmates in the airplane that was shot down didn't make it. They died. Mm. He lived. Mm-hmm. And every fifth year, he has parachuted to honor them. So, boy, as I tell friends, if I, you know, became half as good a dad and person as George Herbert Walker Bush was and is, I'd be one happy dad. Unfortunately for me, I'm not there yet, but I keep trying.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Kurt Smith. He was a speechwriter, major speechwriter for President George Herbert Walker Bush, number 41. And he, we thought we would do a show on presidential libraries because the news was that various places are vying for President Obama's library, Hawaii and Chicago and New York, actually. And so we got to thinking about presidential libraries and found that our guest this hour has written a book on the story of presidential libraries, Kurt Smith. So Kurt is with us this hour. His book looks at 12 of the major presidential libraries, and that's what we're talking about this hour. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm sure many of you listening have been to many of these libraries and would like to say, hey, you should really go to this one or you should go to that one, and this is what I found there that was extraordinary. I want to follow up with we took a group of listeners to Gettysburg and Washington, D.C. a couple years ago and stopped at Ike's house in Gettysburg, which was so modest. I mean, it was just an amazingly modest house. So I'm wondering what's in his library. But there are lots of presidents to talk about their libraries. So let's do it. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about presidential libraries this hour of the program. Kurt Smith is our guest. His book is Windows on the White House, The Story of Presidential Libraries. He was speechwriter for President George Herbert Walker Bush for a number of years and wrote many of his major speeches. He is also a broadcaster, senior lecturer in English at the University of Rochester, and has been renamed to the Baseball Hall of Fame Committee that yearly admits an announcer to the Cooperstown Shrine. Plus, he's done a lot of other things. A Facebook comment has come in, Kurt, that says, from Tim, I have been to the Truman Library in Missouri. It was very enlightening and gave me a healthy respect for his job as president. He walked into quite a time as well, didn't he?
Boy, did he ever. He, of course, was Franklin Roosevelt's third vice president. He was named that by FDR in 1944. And when FDR died on April 12th, 1945, Truman instantly was inaugurated, of course, as America's president. And he had met and talked with Franklin Roosevelt the grand number of times of twice. And didn't even know that America, for a number of years, had been pursuing something called the atomic bomb. So that was rather a shock.
Yeah.
When Roosevelt was told by the Secretaries of Defense and State that America had this wonder weapon, which was nearing completion. And so Truman had enormous, one could say, opportunity, one could say pressure, tension, trouble, certainly fill in the blank, if you would, of having to make a number of decisions, big decisions, within a number of months, almost instantly, as the Pacific and the Atlantic theaters of the war worked their way toward a conclusion. At that time, this was April of 45, and the war ended in the Atlantic theater on May 8th of 1945, and of course in the Pacific theater with Japan surrendering in August of 1945, actually early September, the war ending itself. So boy, he had to be made of stern stuff, and indeed he was. Truman, interesting. On small decisions, he could be petty, he could be profane, he was very partisan, could be vituperative. But on the big decisions, and boy, as I said, he had some. He had to decide, for example, whether to drop the atomic bomb, whether to drop it twice, at Hiroshima and then at Nagasaki. And he dropped it, and he was correct to do so, I think historians would say. He had to decide whether later to fire Douglas MacArthur after MacArthur more or less lost sight of who was president, Truman or him.
Mm-hmm.
He had to decide whether to invade or start United States participation in the Korean War after Korea and Communist China had instigated war in 1950, and he did. So one after another, there were big decisions, and Truman stepped up to the plate, and I think most people would say, in retrospect, made the right decision. And Truman was interesting in another way. You know, he never graduated from college. So he may not have been in what the broadcaster Dizzy Dean called rich in book learning, but he had great common sense. And actually, he was rich in book learning. If you go to the library in Independence, you will find the Harry Truman collection of private books, books that belong to him. And he had the largest collection of books of any president. He was an inveterate reader. He was a great student of history.
Well, you write about some of the books he was reading when he was a kid. Ulysses he was reading, The Last Days of Pompeii, Civilizations of Egypt, Greece, and Mesopotamia. I mean, he was doing some hard studying, wasn't he?
Yes, and I think he shows there's no substitute for that kind of reading, real reading, not, the kind of reading that passes for such today, but reading in the classics, reading in biography, reading in autobiography, the best kind of background, I think, for a president. So the fact that he didn't go to a college seems to me to be totally ungermane.
He gave
himself the best training that a president can have.
And yet, in the chapter in your book, when you write about Harry, you say on October 11, 1948, Newsweek read 50 political experts unanimously predict a Dewey victory. His poll numbers were terrible. Why didn't people like him?
Well, because he was vituperative, and he could be petty. When Dewey died, his Republican opponent, who was heavily favored to overwhelm him in the 48 campaign, in 1971, Dewey died, and Truman would not even issue any kind of statement, mourning Dewey's death. And he had won over Dewey. You would think that he could have mourned him in a rather generous way, but he didn't.
Yeah.
He could be very, very cold, and he could have a very long memory, too long. So, this is one of the reasons that Eisenhower was able to succeed Truman and win such a landslide victory in 52.
Yeah.
People wanted, as they often do, we Americans don't necessarily know what we want in a presidential election. We know what we don't want, and what we don't want is just what we've had. Sort of like in 2008, people didn't know necessarily that they wanted Barack Obama. They knew what they didn't want, and that was George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And what they and Barack Obama gave them basically the un-Bush. In addition to Obama's scholarly charms and his ability to speak, I think the fact that he was the anti or the un-Bush was the largest reason for his landslide.
So Colonel,
I think the same was true with Truman and with Eisenhower.
Uh-huh.
Eisenhower was he was nonpartisan. He was bipartisan. He really never lost his temper, at least privately, or publicly, rather. And he would not be vituperative. He would not be ill-tempered, at least on the public debating and public speaking stage. And Truman could be both. So Truman, again, had this bipolar sort of quality to him. He could be very small, as we think of that term, and yet, boy, as a statesman, he could be awfully big.
Tell me about the libraries. We've been talking mostly about Ike and what's in Truman's library that's particularly noteworthy?
Books and more books. Yeah, and also some of the accoutrements, if you would, of the early part of his career. Truman, I think, shows. Oddly enough, how it's better for a would-be chief executive to suffer. Because I think suffer means that you know how, in essence, to suffer a defeat and then shrug it off and show strength in the face of that kind of adversity. And Truman suffered one bit of adversity after another.
And
he went broke twice.
Yeah.
He had terrible eyesight.
Right.
His glasses resembled a Coke bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you looked at his career, early career, you would say, well, this is a man that will be mediocre at best.
Mm-hmm.
But it taught him. It taught him the ability, if you would, to be strong, and the ability to be brave, and the ability to brook one setback after another. And that the same kind of toughness, incidentally, that Ulysses S. Grant showed.
Mm-hmm.
And Truman was a great admirer of Grant in that sense, in terms of both military and also presidential. And so I think that that's what one of the things that Truman showed us. And when you go to his museum, you see that the military aspect, but also the things that he suffered. And as I mentioned, the big decisions, and one of the big decisions was his courage in taking on Senator Joseph McCarthy
mm-hmm.
in the early 1950s, because people forget this now. But not simply McCarthy's Republican Party, but even more conservative members of the Democratic Party were terribly afraid of taking McCarthy on.
Sure, the Kennedys, McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy.
Bobby Kennedy
yeah.
was one of them.
Yeah.
Jack Kennedy was one of them.
Right.
Many conservative and Catholic, because McCarthy was Irish and he was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So boy, if you represented that constituency in particular, and of course both Kennedys represented Massachusetts, heavily Irish Catholic, and they were scared to death of McCarthy. And this was true in 1949, 50, 51, 52, until, if you would, the fever broke. And sanity began to really, I think, be restored in 53, 54. And then, of course, McCarthy, who, above all, did not wear well, began to be exposed. But, you know, Truman saw through him very early on and showed very early on as well the temerity, the courage to say, look, the emperor has no clothes.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. We're talking about presidential libraries. This got prompted by some recent news articles about where the President Obama library should be. So many people are vying places, Hawaii and Chicago and New York, several places in Chicago. We can ask where you think it should be. And I'm sure many of you listening have, unlike me, been to a lot of these libraries that our guest wrote about. Kurt Smith is our guest. Windows on the White House is his book. He's written many other books, but this is the one that is pertinent to our conversation today, the story of presidential libraries. He was a speechwriter for President Bush, 41, for a number of years. He's a radio commentator. He's a teacher and a television documentarian, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Here's how you reach us. Been to one of the libraries? Let us know what you saw. What's worth seeing? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Let's go to the man who said, if a man is not made a million by the age of 40, he's not worth much. And this man had made $3 million by the time he was 36, even though he was an orphan, had a very tough life and a pretty controversial presidency, but great work as a humanitarian. And I understand that the Hoover Library is very, very good, Kurt. Would you concur?
I sure would. And here is a man, incidentally, that has been praised by many Democratic as well as, of course, Republican former presidents, because Herbert Hoover became sort of the anti-politician, largely because of the Depression. He had the terrible timing of being president when the roof fell in, and that means that he was president on October 24 and October 29 of 1929, when the stock market crashed and then crashed again. And he did his best to rally the nation, but that took a psychologist and a master rhetorician. He was neither. Franklin Roosevelt was both. And when Roosevelt became president in 1932, he rallied the nation very quickly and heroically and historically. But Hoover, I think, was, both parties, Democrat and Republican, people forget, wanted him as their nominee in 1928. This is how popular he was. And he was called the great humanitarian. As Secretary of Commerce, he had helped to feed millions of people in Europe and mm-hmm. helped mastering logistics to make sure that millions of refugees in the wake of World War I had somehow been fed. And he was a man of probity. You're quite right. One of the great phrases, if a man has not made $1 million or several million dollars, by the time he's 40, he's not worth much, which certainly leaves me in the dust.
I know, me too.
Any, perhaps some even of our listeners.
I think quite a few.
he was a man of formality. He was a man of rectitude and honesty and scholarship, none of which meant anything, sadly, in the wake of the Depression,
right,
when Americans wanted to be stirred, mm-hmm. and when they wanted mm-hmm. to be lifted, and when they wanted to be reassured,
right.
Because that necessitated someone who could reach the American soul,
right,
and that meant using the English language as a Churchill would or as an FDR would. So he didn't cry, and he didn't bewail, he didn't blame the American public. Instead, he went on and served the American public. And this has often been said, but this is our definition, should be, of a man.
Yeah. Let's go to Martha in Waukesha. Hi, Martha. Hi, Martha. Martha, are you there? No, Martha is not there. Martha has been to six of the museums. She wanted to know, Kurt, the difference between national museums and private museums.
Well, in terms of presidential museums, the difference would be, for example, all of the presidential museums that merit that title are serviced and organized and run by the National Archives. That does not include the Rutherford B. Hayes Library in Ohio, which is why generally we don't include them among the libraries that are referred to as presidential libraries. I can basically tell you very quickly which libraries are referred to as presidential libraries.
Okay.
Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Bush 41, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Bush 43, and, of course, Barack Obama. They have in common a couple things. Number one, every penny of the money that is raised to build their presidential library is built by you and me and the former president's friends and allies and good buddies and political allies and the folks that have subsidized his career and anyone else he can find who contributes to the cause financially. The very day that the library opens and the key is turned over to the National Archives, you and me and every person in this country begin to pay, because the National Archives runs it. The National Archives is a branch or an umbrella, if you would, of the federal government, and as such, every penny is paid for by Uncle Sam, mm-hmm. meaning us.
Mm-hmm. Email came in wondering why Ronald Reagan's library was not located in his hometown of Dixon, Illinois.
Well, you'd have to ask Nancy Reagan. because I think he was so identified in a consummate and total way with California.
Mm-hmm.
After all, yes, He grew up in rural Illinois. He loved particularly Tampico and Dixon, Illinois. He loved Dixon especially and Eureka College. I always said that he was from Illinois, rural Illinois, and of rural Illinois. And when he went to Hollywood, he was from Hollywood, but never of Hollywood. There's a huge difference, which is why Reagan was such an enormous success politically. But location, location, location matters, not just in real estate, but in where you place a presidential library. And they wanted it close to a population center.
Uh-huh. Sure.
And what better population center if you're going to keep it in California than near L.A.?
Yeah.
After all, this is where he had made movies for Warner Brothers from the late 1930s all the way through the 1950s. This is where he had been the host for General Electric of GE Theater from 1952 into the 1960s. This is where he, this had been his base, where he had run for governor successfully, winning mm-hmm. two landslides in 1966 and also 1970. This is had been his base when he ran for the Republican nomination for president, almost defeating an incumbent, Gerald Ford, in 1976. And this had been his base when he won the Republican nomination in 1980 and 84 and won two landslides for that. So California had served him well, and he had served California well. So I think even though he was small heart, small town at heart, and had been faithful to the small town, and that had served him well, you have to keep it near a major population
right.
center.
Which is hard to believe that the presidential library of Barack Obama would be any place other than Chicago. Well, it could be
I
New
don't
York,
think but... there's any question about
right.
that. My favorite television show of all time was the original Hawaii Five-0, but they would be out of their mind to put it in Hawaii because it's so far away from any population center. You know, you kick off your presidential library and people come to it for the first year, but then a library is faced like any other Hall of Fame or any other library. Once you've been to a library, how do you convince people to come back a second and a third time? That's
right.
That's the challenge that affects any library. And the answer is, you keep it fresh, you keep it clean, and you do it through keeping seminars and having guest speakers,
mm-hmm.
having interesting shows and panels and things of this ilk. You can't do that from Hawaii. It's simply too hard to get to. New York is a joke. He went to he taught at Columbia. People don't even remember that he
right.
did this. There is absolutely no tie between them. You know, not only is there a tie between Chicago and Obama, but basically this is you know where he taught, this is where he began his career in politics,
right.
this is where he rose politically.
Yeah.
This is what made him politically. I would be shocked if it were any area but Chicago, and I'm not shocked too easily, having spent a part of my life in politics. So I expect it to be Chicago, and I think this will be a perfect location for the Obama Library to thrive.
Kurt Smith, our guest, and his book that is pertinent to our conversation is Windows on the White House, The Story of Presidential Libraries. James in Madison has sent us this email. The Herbert Hoover Library is in West Branch, Iowa. This is just under 4 hours from Milwaukee, just 3 hours from Madison. That's not that far, huh? The library, along with the museum and historic site, James writes, are a great place to visit and tour. There you go. Good travel advice for this summer. We'll take more phone calls. We're talking about the libraries of, well, our guest has written about them in his book. Not all of them were built. The book is not brand new, so not all of them were built when he wrote the book. It's the libraries of Rutherford Hayes, Herbert Hoover, FDR, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush. And here's how you reach us. Care to do that? That would be dandy. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls for Kurt Smith, Presidential Libraries, 800-486-8655 is the number. Ann in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Ann.
Hi. With everything being tweeted or, sent little messages that are heavily abbreviated or contracted, I can't imagine what's going to be in future presidential libraries. You know, it's no written communication, everything, and, OMG and IMO. And what will actually, what will be left of our written culture with future presidents?
Well, maybe the presidents don't write OMG. I don't know. But I was talking about this with some friends because I discovered lots of old letters from my mother. What a treasure that was. And she's right. What are we going to have as records for our libraries?
Well, from this former speechwriter, quite a bit. I don't do Facebook, don't do Twitter, don't do
you don't
any of the very pallid substitutes for real writing.
Uh-huh.
Incidentally, if I may, your commercial talking about coming home. I feel in a sense that today because after the Bush administration, I did talk radio for several years in Milwaukee on radio station WISN and did a number of speaking appointments and accounts in Wisconsin and grew to love the state a great deal. I mean, how can you not love a state whose leading broadcaster is Bob Uecker, who once said of Sandy Koufax, he hit 400 off one of the great left-handers of our time, and he said, "I hit 400 off Koufax." That alone should have kept him out of the Hall of Fame. I mean, how do you not love that?
Well,
but
terrific,
we just enjoyed Milwaukee so much.
Good.
And so to me, this is a wonderful nostalgia. But no, I mean the caller was absolutely right about the Hoover Hall Museum and library. And this is true of all of the libraries in the Middle West. They are homespun. They are very modest. They are, I think, emblems of what someone can do without a lot of contacts, without a lot of money, without a lot of people that you can lend upon and lean upon, but rather just through hard work and depending upon yourself. And there are a lot of lessons here. I mean, I have, and in fact, you mentioned the libraries that I've been to. I have been now to all of the libraries, including the latest, including the Clinton, and I look forward to doing the Obama as well, because I'll be doing a reprint, if you would,
an
updated, edited version of this in the next several years. But I'll have people come up to me, and it's very rewarding. Family groups, and they'll come up and they'll say, we did with our kids three or four libraries this year. We're going to do three or four next year. We're going to cap it off the following year. And I love that. Not because it involves me, but it involves them, and it is a wonderful way to really study the whole entirety of American history, really over the last century, dating back to Roosevelt and before him, Herbert Hoover, and really, if you want to count the Rutherford B. Hayes, going back to that as well, but keeping it anecdotal, episodic, and yet involving facts. Interactive, yes, you have to do that today to get involved kids, but not overly so. Not as a substitute, if you would, for substance, but rather to supplement substance, so that kids are interested, so that they understand and can come to realize the wonder and the theater of history that you and I and I will bet you a great majority of your listeners knew when they were growing up.
Sure.
And boy, if we've lost that, we've lost a great amount. But if we can keep that, we will keep alive the wonder that is the history of the United States.
But to Ann's point, when we're using computers and sending so many email messages, is that true for diplomatic language still and for presidential communication, or are people still writing letters?
They're writing letters. I mean, they're because other people write, the tweets and the Facebook and that. And you to some extent have to raise the white flag and to involve that. But you try to do it, at least I do, as little as possible, because I think the best writing is to do it as little as possible. And I'm the kind of person, for better or for worse, that even when it comes to emails, I'll still worry about whether, you know, lines are well-rounded and whether they make sense, and just to make sure that you don't have prepositions hanging at the ends of sentences and this kind of thing. And I would like to think that that is true of a lot of people who do emails. And I think it's a good way to teach our kids so that they will have good grammar and good spelling and good writing when they grow up, because that's something we can't afford to lose.
There has been, I just want to talk about some of the more difficult times in presidents, times of being president. They haven't always had smooth going. They've all been, each of them, some to some degree, some more than others, Richard Nixon being a case of a presidency that ended in utter disgrace. How faithful are libraries in talking about the rough times, the times that perhaps a wrong decision was made, that the president did something that created real significant tension in the world, or did something that was potentially illegal? Do libraries gloss that over completely, Kurt? Does that vary from library to library?
Well, what you try to do, and I understand this totally, is to present as positive a picture of your incumbent, of your principal, as you can. The Nixon Library, surprisingly enough, presents a very honest, if you would, a transcription of Nixon's role in Watergate, which has grown more honest. I think that they were surprised at some of the knocks that they took early on for having not been as forthcoming as they ought to have been. They have become more forthcoming, and I think that the reviews have gotten better. And they have taken pride in events that they should have, and that is Nixon's brilliant record, I would suggest, in foreign policy. The trip to China, the going to the Soviet Union in terms of the first arms of limitation talks ever, and treaty with the Soviet Union, and ending of the war in Vietnam, beginning of peace in the Middle East. Hugh Seide of Time magazine said that he thought Nixon would go down as the greatest foreign policy president, going back to it and possibly including even Franklin Roosevelt. You can certainly make that case. Even though I like the John F. Kennedy Museum very much in Boston, they do not give you an honest picture, for example, of Kennedy's private life. Mm-hmm. They just don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no mention, for example, of the East German spy with whom Kennedy had a liaison, and of other people with whom he had affairs. Maybe there were too many
of them.
Well, you know, that's very true.
Right.
But I'm telling you, there's just nothing. You know, Bill Clinton's at least had some regarding Monica Lewinsky. Lyndon Johnson's, I think, tries to put Vietnam in a context which is difficult to do, because I think the tragedy for Johnson is this is a man with no interest in foreign policy, no background in foreign policy, mm-hmm. whose career and presidency were destroyed by foreign policy. I mean, think about that. So it all depends. I will look forward to Obama in terms of how he treats, for example, Obamacare. How will he treat that? How will he treat, you know, the Middle East? How will he treat Iran? You just don't know. And, of course, we don't know. So I think it takes a number of years for the presidential libraries themselves to sort themselves out so that we can sort them out. But I think presidential libraries, I've seen all of the first thing that you see when you go to a presidential library is the biography that they have showing to you. And you get a good sense there in terms of how they intend and what they intend show to you as the message coloring the entire library.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Kurt, very much for being with us. Kurt Smith, our guest this hour, Presidential Libraries, our topic, and the book that he wrote on this a few years ago, but really nicely done, is Windows on the White House, The Story of Presidential Libraries. Kurt was a major speechwriter for President George Herbert Walker Bush, President number 41, and has been a radio broadcaster, TV documentarian, and all kinds of things. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where it's a beautiful day. Thank you for listening. Great conversations ahead.